Sometimes when we talk, we don't know what the fuck, so we have to call and ask a friend. I wanna know the things you know, it'll make a better show. You're the one on whom we all depend.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Phone a Friend. Our guest today is George Laws Garcia, the executive director of the Puerto Rico Statehood Council. A longtime policy advocate and consultant and a native of San Juan, Laws Garcia was tapped to be the organization's first executive director to increase the engagement of Puerto Rico statehood supporters. George and I have a great conversation about the hows and whys of statehood, roadblocks and resistance the movement faces, and the tension between advocates for statehood versus full independence. And he is a wealth of information with an extremely thoughtful approach that I know you're going to appreciate. And he doesn't shy away from the dark side of the imperial and colonial relationship between the U.S. and Puerto Rico, and some of the atrocities that those who are unfamiliar with our past might find surprising. Without further ado, here's my conversation with George Laws Garcia of the Puerto Rico Statehood Council. George, thank you for joining the show today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Max. Pleasure to be here.
So one of my favorite places, and this may be unusual, I don't know, you can tell me, as a native Puerto Rican, is the kiosks in Luquillo.
Oh, they're awesome. The best alcapurrias you can get anywhere.
There we go. See, now I'm not going to be one of those interviewers that struggles through pronunciations and that sounds like that newscaster that mispronounces Nicaragua. So I'm going to leave all the cool stuff for you.
Cool.
Yeah. So Luquillo happens to be just like one of those happy places because you've got the beach and then you have a whole bunch of fried food. I mean, it's a lot of mixed messaging for your body.
There's places where you can dance and have some drinks and get some cold beers. It's fantastic.
It's just the coolest. And for that reason alone, we should give Puerto Rico statehood. Thanks for joining us, everybody. We really appreciate you. So one of the places that I wanted to start is actually by codifying our understanding of what Puerto Rico is. I am from New York also, so I will say Puerto Rico. It just comes out. All right. So what is Puerto Rico?
Sure. So Puerto Rico is a territory of the United States. Under the U.S. Constitution, there are states, right? There's the District of Columbia, which is the seat of government. And there are these other jurisdictions that are territories, right? Territories are basically pieces of land that the United States government owns on behalf of the American people. And specifically, Congress has the power to basically do whatever it wants with regards to territories. And unfortunately, they're not just land, right? They're also places where you have hundreds of thousands, and in the case of Puerto Rico, millions of U.S. citizens. Territories have two main flaws to them. One is that they get treated unequally under federal laws and programs, and Congress can discriminate against them in whichever way it likes and determines. And it has to have just the barest justification possible to pass constitutional muster, which is terrible because it means that people want to leave and have lower quality of life there. And then the other part is the democratic deficit, right? We're United States citizens. We're subject to federal laws that Congress passes, and we're subject to whatever the executive branch and the president does to execute those laws. Yet we don't have a direct say in those laws, how they're made, and electing the people who actually bring them into force. So we can only elect one non-voting member of Congress that sits in the U.S. House called the resident commissioner, but we have no representation in the U.S. Senate. And in the House, we have the population that would normally get a state, you know, four representatives. And instead, our resident commissioner can vote in committees, but they can't vote on the floor in the House. And then to top it off, when election time comes this November, we can't vote for president. And obviously, that's something that is detrimental to the people of Puerto Rico. And I think one of the clearest examples of when a lack of capacity to influence the presidential election was in play was when Puerto Rico was hit by Hurricane Irma and then Hurricane Maria in 2017. And the sitting president then, Donald Trump, basically threw paper towels at us, as opposed to actually really addressing our needs in the same way that the federal government addressed for Texas and Florida, which had also gone through terrible hurricanes in that time.
Yeah, I do want to talk about the hurricane and the aftermath of that, and then what that portended for the budget and the finances after Puerto Rico went under the control board. But I just want to stay for a moment on how we think about how Americans, how United States citizens think about Puerto Rico, because what you're describing is a colony.
Basically.
Right?
Yep.
And just as a quick corollary to that, are there any other U.S. colonies that are exactly in the same position as Puerto Rico? Do we consider American Samoa to be an exact corollary to that? Or is there any, what are the differences there?
So the United States, under its constitution, doesn't have colonies, right? They call it territories. But for all practical purposes, the net experience is that of colonization. United States currently has five colonies and territories. They're Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands, which are the two ones in the Caribbean. And then in the Pacific, we've got the Commonwealth of Northern Mariana Islands. We've got Guam, and then we've got American Samoa. Each one of them has come into the relationship with the United States through different, you know, histories, and they've got different cultural backgrounds. All of them basically are subject to the plenary powers of Congress, but how the local governance is executed in each of them varies. For example, Puerto Rico, basically Congress authorized in 1953 us to have our own locally established constitution. They, of course, modified our proposal for what the Constitution should be because Congress can do those kinds of things. But we basically run and operate essentially like a state. We have an elected governor, elected legislature with a House and a Senate. We've got appointed judiciary. And then we've got, you know, mayors and, you know, subdivisions similar to what a state would have. So at the local level, we're kind of locally self-governing. Until in 2014 and 15, Puerto Rico entered a fiscal crisis, in large part because of the situation of being treated unequally as a territory and the cumulative impact of federal disinvestment. And the government basically needed to try to keep its citizens happy because people were leaving Puerto Rico. And in order to address that, they borrowed until it got to a point where you get to the fiscal debt crisis. And then Congress said, you know what? It's really cute that you did this whole constitution thing in 1953. That's awesome. And now we're imposing this unelected fiscal oversight board where seven people appointed by the president from recommendations made by Congress can basically overturn laws in Puerto Rico, irrespective of the fact that they've been approved by our governor and our legislature. So I think that that's what makes it absolutely clear that Puerto Rico is in a state of colonialism. But the other territories, they've got different situations. Not all of them have a locally established government that is of its own constitutional formation. They operate under organic acts, or in the case of the Commonwealth of Northern Mariana Islands, they have a so-called compact, which is supposed to be an agreement between equals, but in reality and in practice, it's not. And American Samoa has a completely different relationship where they're not United States citizens. They're U.S. nationals. Then locally, they have a kind of tribal governance structure that is in place there and is respected. But for all practical purposes, the United States Congress can do whatever it wants. And it does so often. They expand military operations in those countries, and especially with all the growing threats in China and the Pacific Rim, you know, they're having huge impact on those places. And the locals have, you know, very limited say in how things go down.
Let's stay on the economic circumstances in Puerto Rico for a little bit, because I think that there's also kind of a lack of understanding of how we are connected, because the regulatory system, the banking system, is all kind of technically under the U.S. federal framework. But then you have some independence in terms of budget and borrowing in Puerto Rico. But not the same type of independence that a nation state might, because and the backdrop for this is one of the things that we're embarking on right now is we're kind of refreshing on our understanding of the border crisis. And then so we're talking about Latin American and Caribbean economies, the LAC economies, and how each one of them is different, how the political circumstances, our foreign policy, safety, security measures, natural resources, and then just the baseline economic conditions in each of these regions contribute to net migration and net outflow into the country. Because that's usually what people are thinking of when they're thinking of Latin American and Caribbean economies. Well, is like, well, who's trying to get here? And it's this very ethnocentric and myopic mindset we have. But when we talk about those Latin American economies, they have a remarkable amount of independence. They have the ability to go out and make their own trade agreements with, let's say, China or Taiwan. They have the ability to borrow money from those sovereign entities, but also from the IMF. Those opportunities don't really exist to that same extent for Puerto Rico. So it's like, oh, you're independent, but you still just only have us to deal with. Is that a fair characterization? And can you explain a little bit?
No, Puerto Rico is not independent in any way, right? So Puerto Rico has always, for the past 125 years, since 1898, it was acquired during the Spanish-American War, been a territory. And a territory is subject to the plenary powers of Congress, which is the capacity of Congress to make all needful rules and regulations respecting that jurisdiction. There was a period of time in, where people in Puerto Rico thought that because Congress granted us the capacity to establish this local constitution called the Commonwealth, that we had achieved some level of self-governance, right? And that fantasy over time, a lot of people became disillusioned, which is why we, ended up having all of these plebiscites in total six from 1967 until the latest one in 2020. Where voters in Puerto Rico were being asked, what non-territorial options do you want? Because clearly the territory sucks. And the culminating point, I think, for that idea that Puerto Rico had achieved some kind of separate sovereignty or local self-governance that was on some kind of a equal level or some degree of independence got blown to bits in 2016 with a Supreme Court case called Sanchez Valle. And in that case, the Supreme Court basically affirmed that the sovereignty over Puerto Rico rests solely in the hands of Congress. So unlike other countries in Latin America, whether that's, Cuba, Dominican Republic, El Salvador, Colombia, wherever else, they're all sovereigns, right? They have sovereign nation state status. Puerto Rico is a jurisdiction that belongs to the United States, even if it's not inherently a part of the United States.
So in the economic example that we're talking about, then is kind of a roundabout way of suggesting that the opportunities that exist for other sovereign entities to reach out to organizations like the IMF, or even to, let's say, consolidate their debt through the auspices of what the Chinese government is doing in so many Latin American economies, an opportunity doesn't exist for Puerto Rico.
No.
They don't have that type of financial independence.
No, we're completely subject to the jurisdiction of the federal government, Congress, the U.S. Treasury, the Federal Reserve Board. The whole shebang. Puerto Rico has only whatever limited local self-government powers that Congress decides to cede to Puerto Rico. But at any point, Congress can pull those back. And that's basically the lesson that the U.S. citizens of Puerto Rico learned very rudely, not just because of that Supreme Court case in 2016, but 2016 also saw the passage of PROMESA, which is the law that basically allowed for Puerto Rico to restructure its debt. But Congress then passed this fiscal oversight board, which essentially is like the government nanny taking care of the children that can't handle themselves, right?
Is there a sunset for that, or is that in perpetuity?
There is a process for that to be removed, and it requires certain conditions to be met. And some of those conditions include the approval of a certified budget by the oversight board, and then that the government basically meets that certified budget. And then for, I think, like 5 years in a row. And then also Puerto Rico has to be able to re-enter the capital markets and issue new debts. as long as it's done in a way that is done for kind of longer term infrastructure investments and not for kind of covering ongoing spending. And all of that has to be approved by the board. So the board has really been put in a position where they have the capacity to determine at what point they exit, and they have basically, you know, no real incentive, as far as I'm aware, to, you know, make sure that, you know, they do exit, right? And that's a huge, huge problem, because you've taken what was already a significant democratic deficit when you're subject to federal laws, but you don't have any say in them, and you increase that vastly, because now you also don't have any real say over any, you know, significant budgetary decision or financial decision for the jurisdiction, even at the local level, whenever the board decides to intervene on our behalf.
So I have a number of, again, procedural questions. Sure. About kind of what comes next and where you're at right now in this moment in order to actually achieve statehood. You talked about the 2016 SCOTUS ruling, and I'd like to hang there for just a minute and sort of work like from a top-down basis. Why was that in front of the Supreme Court? What were they looking at? What was the case? How did it get there? And why were they taking that up at that particular time?
The case addressed an issue of the double jeopardy in a criminal case. Puerto Rico is basically exercising its prosecutorial role at the local level. And the ultimate decision is that there aren't two separate sovereigns, where Puerto Rico could be kind of like a state and the federal government is a separate, you know, sovereign, which was, you know, one of the arguments that was brought up by one of the parties in the case. Instead, the Supreme Court decided, you know what, there is no double jeopardy because Puerto Rico's local government is a part of the sovereignty of the United States. The only real sovereign is Congress. So that's what led to the case. But after that, there's actually been a series of other cases that are now being called kind of the new insular cases that included cases related to the Fiscal Oversight Board. Franklin Templeton, I think, was one of the names of one of them. And then more recently, there was Baello Madero, which was a case about federal benefits on the island for a person who is Puerto Rican, lived stateside, you know, acquired those benefits because they were disabled. And then they moved to Puerto Rico and the federal government basically, you know, sued the person asking him to pay back all the benefits that they'd received. And they're like, wait, what does it matter? Right. And ultimately, what the Supreme Court decided there is that Congress has the capacity to treat Puerto Rico in a discriminatory way at any point. And even if it gives a particular federal benefit, it can take it back at any point. So baked into the structure of America's territorial governance is the capacity to treat territories unequally. And there's nothing you can do about that except to create a path out of colonial territorialism and into non-territorial status options. And that's the work that my organization and I have been involved in trying to advance.
It's amazing. So we do a lot of work with Native rights and Indigenous rights in North America, a little different the way things are managed in Canada versus the United States. But it seems to me, as you're talking, that Puerto Rico exists in almost this weird purgatory between the reservation system that we have in the United States and then, you know, what would be considered, you know, a full sovereign nation with treaty agreements and trade alliances. And it's something that I think more people should understand, that this is a true colonial relationship, but by any other name. You've identified already legal structures, economic structures. On the social front, though, it's amazing to me how, I guess as a New Yorker, I'm a little biased because Puerto Rican culture is so much a part of New York culture and New York heritage, that I also think that in a way that that sort of masks the fact that these really are to complete, that this is a subordinate entity. So many of us, at least in New York, view Puerto Rico as an extension of New York. And yep. By that nature, it's sort of like, well, I guess they all have the same rights and titles to just absolutely everything that we do. But, you know, the New York Fed just published economic data trying to benchmark Puerto Rico's recovery. And the numbers are still pretty dire. As I'm looking at it, we have There's been a 12% population decline over the last 10-year period, which is substantial.
It's devastating. It's not substantial.
Yeah, devastating. I believe the United States has seen a 7% increase over that same exact period. There's still 5.7% unemployment, not a nightmare compared to the levels that it was at. But when you look at the composition and the characteristics of the jobs that are there, it contributes to an average of a $20,000 median household income. That, to me, is a scandal. That's a story unto itself. Because we're talking about, in the United States, with all the pockets of poverty and the inequality that we're experiencing in the United States, that number is 67,000. Yep. So you're talking about orders of magnitude worse, the conditions there, despite there being kind of healthy employment, especially if you were to benchmark Puerto Rico against some of the other Latin American economies that went through a substantial crisis over the past couple of decades. It's still doing relatively well if we compare it on certain measures, maybe GDP per capita or maybe employment. But that household income figure to me is the one that really stands out. Can you describe the social and cultural impact that has upon the residents of Puerto Rico?
Yeah, so the impact is massive, and it is related directly to this, you know, feature of territorial inequality, because as the federal government approves laws with regards to every single different aspect of federal legislation, healthcare, education, transportation, you know, you name it, it can treat territories differently, and it does so. And in the case of Puerto Rico, for example, our elderly people that are dependent on Medicare, they pay into the system because Puerto Ricans pay payroll taxes, which is something a lot of people don't know. But they get less benefits as a result of that. And some benefits they just don't get at all in Puerto Rico, like nursing home care is not something that's included in the Medicare benefits on the island. So you have a huge population of elderly people that are denied full access to, you know, nursing home care, which is, you know, a hugely important issue for their well-being. And it inevitably has economic impacts because the people who are caring for them, their family members, can't work in the economy because they have to care for these individuals. So that's, you know, one example right there. Puerto Rico receives different nutritional assistance programs. So instead of receiving SNAP, which is received stateside, you know, everywhere, that provides nutritional support for families that are of lower income. In Puerto Rico, we get a separate program that has a much lower benefit level called NAP, right? And that means that there's higher rates of child poverty on the island and malnutrition. And as a result, of course, you know, the nutrition that you get, especially when you're younger, is a determinant factor and a social determinant for all kinds of, you know, health and developmental conditions. So in Puerto Rico, we have significant health disparities. Access to Medicaid in Puerto Rico is capped. So across the states, your Medicaid allocation is based on your population. In Puerto Rico, there's an arbitrary cap where Congress just said, hey, we're going to put it at this level. And it's like, what's that based on? We're just putting it here. And Obamacare increased that level, but it didn't actually do so on a regular basis. It basically did so for a period of time. And then now Puerto Rico, every 2 to 3, you know, years, faces something called the Medicaid cliff, where all of a sudden, unless Congress takes action to approve a budget, which we're seeing right now that they're having a lot of hard time doing that, suddenly Puerto Rico faces this, you know, Medicaid cliff. So what does that do? It creates uncertainty with all of our medical service providers. So doctors leave the island. The hospitals don't get the resources that they need. So they have, you know, less capacity to invest in the, you know, products and services to provide healthcare. You know, all of these things also have a impact on the macro economy in Puerto Rico, because that's less money that's circulating economy. You're reducing the velocity of money in the economy. You're reducing the amount of money that ends up in small businesses that create jobs. You're reducing the amount of money that can then be part of the fiscal base so that the government can actually collect taxes and pay off its debts and make investments in education, roads, schools, et cetera. So, you know, that's kind of the bigger picture of what we're seeing here in terms of the territorial inequality. And the worst indicator of that is that 12% figure that you said. Losing 12% of your population is not only incredibly devastating economically, because you're losing your workforce, you're losing consumer demand, and you're losing your tax base, but at the human level, you're tearing apart families and communities. Mm-hmm. And Americans across, you know, the political spectrum are looking at what's happening in the border of the United States, and immigration is front and center as an issue. Puerto Ricans are not immigrants. We're United States citizens.
Right.
No one's really looking at the terrible impact of breaking apart all of these families that are not being able to be there for each other, and the impact that that has on our elderly and our children that are then moving stateside with their parents looking for better opportunities, but then are disconnected from their other family members on the island. That's devastating. And that's not something I'm saying in the abstract. That's something I've lived in my own life. I left Puerto Rico at 18. My mom left Puerto Rico soon thereafter. My sister too, my dad, most of my cousins. So I've got, you know, family literally all over New York, Florida, Washington State, Oregon, you know, California, Texas, you name it. And, you know, now I go back to Puerto Rico and I'm a tourist.
I'm going to say that that's actually one of the that's one of the problems that I think should put this on the front burner, is that we used to be the net beneficiaries of the Puerto Rican migration coming to New York. And so music got better, food got better, life got better, everything got a lot cooler. But now that they're branching out and they're going to other parts of the country, that doesn't really work for us. So I think it's time for statehood. Let me press you on something, though. Before we talk about how statehood, I just want to talk about why statehood. And I just want to run through some of our greatest colonial, imperial, and neoliberal greatest hits here. Our relationship started, was kind of forged in blood. It was forged through war and occupation in 1898. Then we made Puerto Rico an official territory in 1917, moments before we entered World War II, so that we could conscript Puerto Rican men into the army to go fight our battles. There have been covert assassinations and outright massacres at the hands of federal agencies, U.S. federal agencies in Puerto Rico against those that have been vying for independence. And that has happened across the board historically. Forced sterilization of more than 100,000 Puerto Rican women, and then some other experimentations that led to the net effect for hundreds of thousands of more of sterilization. Taking control of your banking, of your laws, subordinating the Constitution itself. To call us the worst partner in the history of partnerships might be an understatement. So I want to put that out there, because I don't think that people are as familiar. I think they kind of can wrap their minds around the colonial aspect of it from a cultural standpoint, from an economic standpoint, and oh, that must be hard, and I see and I get that's difficult, and there might be a political solution to this. But the atrocities that we have committed on the island are horrific.
They're terrible.
And we cannot turn a blind eye to that in this discussion, in my opinion. Like, some people may want to put that as ancient history, but it just leads me to ask the why statehood versus vying for just outright independence, considering just how terrible of a partner we have been historically.
You know, I think that it's absolutely essential to acknowledge all of the incredibly detrimental things that have happened in the relationship between Puerto Rico and the United States. But it's not the only things that have happened, right? You know, in Puerto Rico, the quality of life, the education, the healthcare, the infrastructure vastly improved from when we were a colony of Spain, even during the times in which, you know, many of those things that you're talking about have happened to this day. So inevitably, you have on the island mixed feelings about the relationship with the United States, where some people feel very close to the United States. A lot of them have, you know, served in the military. You know, both my grandfather served in the military, my dad, my stepfather, And when you go through that, you know, it creates its own set of bonds and sense of connection with the United States, because you've sacrificed a lot on behalf of the country. And the vast majority of people in Puerto Rico treasure their American citizenship. I'm saying something like 95-98% of people in Puerto Rico, you know, want to keep their American citizenship. They love their American citizenship, and they value that in large part because, hey, they're looking at the people who are literally crossing deserts, crossing oceans, you know, facing coyotes and sharks and like all drug traffickers and all kinds of things to be able to have the opportunity to come here. And, you know, in Puerto Rico, for better or for worse, we're born United States citizens. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a huge factor. I think the other thing is that at this point in history, the vast majority of Puerto Ricans are now living stateside. The population of Puerto Ricans stateside is up to 6 million nowadays. I think it's 5.9, almost 6, right? On the island, the population at its peak in 2000 was 4 million, and since then has fallen down to 3.2. Now, if Puerto Rico becomes an independent country, you basically are creating a separate sovereign. And what do you do with the United States citizenship of all of those people that are in a separate country? Some people believe that Puerto Rico could become independent or achieve independence and free association and keep its U.S. citizenship. But in my view, and in the view of many who've studied this issue very carefully, you wouldn't really have an actual full independence or full sovereignty at that point, because the United States government would retain a residual sovereignty to be able to, you know, care for the needs of its own citizens in the future. So you would essentially create a kind of like subordinated independence. And does that really even make sense? Mm. So while I completely understand and respect the people who support independence, I think independence is a valid non-territorial, non-colonial status option. And I support the people who, you know, want free association, you know, if they understand clearly that it is a form of independence for the purpose of the U.S. Constitution, you're outside of the U.S. Constitution. What I really think is most critical now is that Congress and the American people recognize that we can't continue holding colonies after 125 years, that needs to end. And the only option for allowing the people of Puerto Rico to get out of the colonial status is to give them a choice among the non-territory options. So that's why we've been working to support the Puerto Rico Status Act, which is legislation that passed the House in December 2022. It's been introduced in this session, both in the House and now version in the Senate. And what it does is it says, colonialism's wrong. We need to stop that. Here are the viable non-territorial options that are available under the U.S. Constitution: statehood, independence, and independence with free association, and then allow the U.S. citizens of Puerto Rico to make a choice for themselves, an informed choice, and then basically allow democracy to work its way and have the will of the majority be what decides. I'm confident that I think the majority of people in Puerto Rico, if they're offered statehood, full equality, and full democracy, I think that's what they're going to choose, because we've already identified with the United States. Most of our family members are over here. We believe in being able to fully participate in the country that we're citizens of. And frankly, from my perspective, I think a United States with a state of Puerto Rico is a better union. It is a more perfect union. It is a country that's living up to its values of a pluribus unum and a plural, multiracial, diverse democracy.
So those are all laudable talking points for sure. And I believe that I think that any empathetic, thinking, feeling human person is going to look at that and be like, it's time. It's time. And I totally get that. So now let's talk about the dark side, the political side.
Yeah.
When you run into, a two-part question. First of all, when you run into opposition, what does it look like? And let's just say it out loud. Is it that Republicans are afraid to have more Democratic voters in the overall electorate? Is there a racial element to this and just straight up unfounded racism that's part of this colonial mindset? So what is the type of interference that you run into? The second part of that Is this the political moment? Because it feels to me that you're actually, based on the Civil Rights Commission coming out and making their declarations, which I'd love for you to talk about, the fact that these bills are, to me, it seems like they advanced a little bit further. They're a lot clearer than maybe prior efforts. What interference do you run into? And is this the political moment that you really believe in your heart this is achievable?
So the political interference, I think, is definitely related to perceptions by politicians, particularly in Congress, about what the political outcome and the net outcome of Puerto Rico possibly becoming a state would be, which is incredibly self-centered and doesn't actually recognize the agency of the people in Puerto Rico to actually decide their own future. And in that sense, it's kind of insulting. Whether it's on the Democratic side by Democrats being like, yes, yes, let's make Puerto Rico a state so we can get two more Democrat senators and four more Democrat representatives, right? Or on the Republican side, be like, no, 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 don't do it, because imagine they'll take away our power, like Lindsey Graham said, right? You know, he literally was quoted, you know, saying DC and Puerto Rico, you know, like if they're made states, then, you know, it literally dilutes our power. He couldn't have been talking about Democrat or Republican power, because if you actually look at who Puerto Rico elected as our resident commissioner right now in the House of Representatives, she's Republican. Her name's Jennifer Gonzalez, right? And she's the top, you know, vote getter in the last three election cycles in Puerto Rico, right? So what do you see from that? You see that, you know, it's a racial thing, right? At least from him. I think a lot of other members are more adroit in how they manage to communicate that. But some aren't. You know, in 2022, we had hearings in the U.S. House of Representatives Natural Resources Committee, and we had members that on the Republican side that were talking about, you know, how Puerto Ricans' children had lower performance on standardized tests and all of this stuff, basically kind of implying that Puerto Ricans are dumb, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it was straight racist, you know, sentiment. And I was listening to that, and it hurt my heart to listen to that, to think that in 2022, you have someone just spouting off like ridiculousness of that nature. So that's all, you know, part of it. The reality is in Puerto Rico, politics are complicated. For the mass majority of Puerto Rico's last 125 years, political parties haven't been divided among Republican or Democrat. They've been divided on this issue of political status. So you have a very small independence party that has traditionally had between 2-4% of the electorate. You have had a pro-Commonwealth party, which has supported continuing to be a territory, but improving that territory in some way. And sometimes their proposals have been unconstitutional, and they've failed at actually improving the territory in a significant way, which is why their, you know, share of the electorate has been reduced overall. And then you have the pro-statehood party, which has grown in its support, but it's also had a lot of governors that have had, you know, significant issues. I worked for two governors in this party, Luis Fortuño, who was Republican, and Ricardo Rosselló, who was a Democrat. And in 2019, you know, the people of Puerto Rico basically rose up and had a mass demonstration, the biggest ones that we've had in our history. And he was pushed out of government. And people like me, capable, intelligent, you know, wanting to make a difference and do good, you know, we resigned out of principle, right? That is an interesting thing to look at, because when people stateside think Puerto Rico will automatically be Democrat and automatically be Republican, That's not necessarily the case. You know, if you look at rural areas in Puerto Rico, or you look at religious communities in Puerto Rico, there's a lot of conservatives there. We even have now a fringe conservative Christian party that has recently come up in these last couple of elections. We also have a new youth-led kind of progressive party that's, you know, very much focused on a lot of the issues that the progressive left is focused on here in the United States. It's interesting, but the reality is I think that Puerto Rico is going to end up as a state being a swing jurisdiction. I think it'll probably be center left, you know, but there's a lot of moderates on the island. And I think the political party that ultimately speaks to the actual interests of the people of Puerto Rico, speaks to their needs, speaks to, you know, what people want to see happen in society, which is improvements in education, improvements in economic opportunity, improvements in healthcare. A lot of the same things that regular everyday Americans everywhere else are concerned with making sure that happens, that those are the parties that are going to be able to be successful locally.
Are you really suggesting that Puerto Ricans are just like us?
Well, you know, we also have really awesome music like reggaeton, right? We also produce amazing talents like, you know, Jennifer Lopez and Mark Anthony and, you know, Sonia Sotomayor. We've got a little swag to us. Yeah.
So, all right. So let's talk about the how and whether or not this is this the moment. Is this the political moment? And kind of if you could describe to us actually what that means, because there's nobody out there to wave a magic wand and be like, you're a state. How does this happen?
So procedurally, Congress shall have the power to admit new states into the union. That's in the Constitution. It's baked in. We've done it 37 times and it works. And it's pretty simple. You pass a single standalone bill, or you can tack it on to some other package, because thankfully there's nothing in the Constitution that prevents you from doing that. And basically you either offer admission. In the case of Alaska and Hawaii, they basically, you know, offered admission and then requested that the citizens there ratify that offer with a statehood yes or no vote, right? In Alaska and Hawaii, on both occasions, they had held locally sponsored votes and, you know, statehood had won a majority. That's already happened in Puerto Rico three times in 2012, 2017, and in 2020. But when Congress offers it, the percentages every single time go up. Why? Because you're getting a final formal offer, right? And once the people, you know, ratify that, then, you know, you're basically, you know, admitted into the union. So that's basically how it goes. You don't have to pass a constitutional amendment. You don't need to get a supermajority in the House or in the Senate. It's actually one of the easiest ways to create a permanent structural change in the power distribution in the United States, because you'd automatically add, you know, two United States senators, which would inevitably represent the jurisdiction where it's 98 or 99% Hispanic, and you would add, you know, four members to the House, or, you know, redistribute that in the next apportionment process. So that's what was needed to happen procedurally. Now, the Puerto Rico Status Act varies from that, because as a non-incorporated territory, meaning that, you know, we're not automatically destined for statehood in the way that Alaska and Hawaii were, Puerto Rico technically still has the option of independence available as a non-territorial alternative. So what the Puerto Rico Status Act does is it presents that offer of admission, and it's binding, but then it also offers these other two forms of independence called, you know, regular independence and then independence with free association. And right now, the United States has a free association relationship with a couple of countries. I believe it's Palau, Federated States of Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands, which are all islands in the kind of first chain of islands that, you know, basically are America's buffer against the possibility that China would essentially take over the Pacific. And in those countries, they have no United States citizenship. They've got separate president. They've got a seat at the UN, and they get, you know, some federal support from us, and they get protection from the US military. But at any point, Congress can end the agreement, because otherwise there's, you know, there's no freedom. So it's unilaterally revocable by either side. And then we have the issue of the compact renewals, which means that, you know, every certain period of time, you know, the agreement needs to be, you know, reapproved by Congress. And right now we have a situation where Congress has failed to approve the compact renewals for a better part of a year already. So these countries are kind of in a limbo. They've got this relationship with the United States. They're expecting all of this support, but Congress hasn't gotten its act together. So there's, you know, there's this inherent vulnerability that comes up with free association. So that's basically what the Puerto Rico Status Act is presenting. And once the voters choose statehood, independence, or free association, then it has an implementation mechanism where whatever people choose actually comes to fruition. And that is historic.
So how much of your time advocating and teaching people is spent here versus Puerto Rico? Because I imagine that you actually have to, you know, inform the, you know, hey, this is what we're up to. Here are the options on the table. Because you said, as you said, it's not binary. It's not, you know, statehood or bust. It's statehood or independence or some different type of relationship. So does your advocacy work extend to the island as well? And do you find resistance there?
Definitely. We extend our efforts both here in D.C. Here in D.C., we focus on Congress and, you know, the federal executive, but mostly Congress most of the time. We're also building up, you know, alliances and partnerships with other organizations and other entities and other movements that are also addressing some of the same issues that we're confronting and trying to really kind of, you know, spread the word about this issue, but also showcase how we can be supportive of other communities, because ultimately this is something that impacts the structure of American democracy as a whole, right? Mm-hmm. If you added two additional United States senators, imagine all the pieces of legislation that you could have passed to improve America in very significant ways over just the last, you know, 2 to 3 years, where the balance of power has been, you know, incredibly tight. Mm-hmm. You know, there's huge issues that could benefit from, you know, having the opportunity to have, you know, two new senators and four representatives from the island have a seat at the table. In terms of Puerto Rico, we have a network of activists from the states and the island. It's called the Puerto Rico Statehood Action Network. And there's also something else called the Extended Delegation. And they've basically been kind of bringing together people who are on the ground in the island, you know, voting on this issue, who are addressing this issue because they're, you know, housewives, because they're grandmothers, because they're veterans, because they're students, because, you know, they're doctors, and they're just tired of this issue, you know, being something that's holding Puerto Rico back from reaching its full potential. And, you know, they're saying, you know what, I'm not powerless. I can do something about this. And our work is to inform them about what's happening in Congress, you know, support them in developing tactics and initiatives that they can do to help impact Congress. So we've had a ton of different fly-ins come in, and then we have to DC to you know, advocate with congressional offices. And then we have advocates stateside from the stateside Puerto Rican community and other allies joining in. And that's where the power is really developing right now. And that's why the moment that we're talking about, it's happening, right? So in 2022, we had that bill pass the House. It was December 15th, 2022. It was right at the tail end. It passed with unanimous support from House Democrats. It passed with 16 Republican votes, which is nearly miraculous when Republicans were going to take over the majority just, you know, a couple weeks later. And it shows that there is, you know, some level of bipartisan support for this. And it passed with a statement of administration policy from the Biden administration saying that if you pass this bill and bring it to my desk, I will sign it, right? That's not insignificant. So our focus during this session of Congress has been on getting that bill reintroduced in the House, which it has. And now it has, I think, close to 90 co-sponsors, also with bipartisan support, which is amazing given how divisive Congress is mm-hmm. right now. And we have introduced it for the first time in the United States Senate. And now we have 23 U.S. senators, at this point, all Democrats, supporting this. So nearly a quarter of the United States Senate is saying, hey, this is an issue that needs to be addressed. Our immediate play is to push for hearings in the House and in the Senate so we can continue building attention to this, because given the mess that's going on in Congress and the election year, the probability of us actually passing full legislation during this immediate session, not so great. But we've got November coming along. And at some point, whether it's this November or, you know, the following one or the one after that, there is going to be a window of opportunity legislatively that's going to happen where we're going to have the capacity to pass it through the House. We're going to have the majority of the Senate's on board. And God willing, we have a sitting president that's willing to sign this into law and give the U.S. citizens of Puerto Rico a choice, a definitive choice about their future.
So I guess one of the things that I didn't understand or appreciate is that this type of bill follows the exact same trajectory as any other bill. There's no special circumstance for statehood. And my reason for asking you that is that this does actually, it's not just a congressional issue. It does require alignment with the executive branch as well. You need a sign off.
All legislation does. I mean, the president signs every single bill that becomes law. That's fundamental.
So this isn't this doesn't follow a different path. This is like any other bill. Okay.
Yep.
Have you thought about approaching Canada?
You know, that's a great question. If you ask Russia, Puerto Rico should, you know, consider becoming a, you know, separate state. If you ask Trump, we should be part of, we traded for Greenland or something crazy like that. I mean, there's all kinds of like weird proposals. There's people in Puerto Rico who believe that Puerto Rico should be returned to Spain because they see that that's where, you know, our citizenship and our roots are.
That's
and,
progressive.
You know, that's like,
I mean, regressive.
Yeah. Well, now they're looking at, yeah, Spain's part of the European Union. Ah, that'd be kind of nice, right? But, you know, the reality is it doesn't really make sense with the last 125 years of relationship that we've had with the States. You know, 6 million Puerto Ricans living stateside, you know, having Puerto Rico kind of like reduce or significantly separate its bonds, like with the United States. If you right now told everyone who has a child in Puerto Rico, hey, any child that's born after this moment loses their United States citizenship and they would have to apply for a visa to come to the United States or have some other arrangement that Congress could change at any point in the future, people would be like, hell no, that's crazy.
Mm. So just one last question before I let you go. More on the human side of things. I was last in Puerto Rico within the year. I was there several months ago. It is one of my favorite places, by the way. I absolutely love it and have been several times. And this was the first time in a few years, though, because, you know, kids and life and all that stuff the good stuff that gets in the way. So my family and I, we went down there and it struck me as when we first got there and we were in the more populated areas, we were in San Juan and then we were, you know, kind of moving around. We went actually stayed in a different town. Everything looked, you know, great, back to normal, kind of what we expected. And then as I got off the beaten path, it became so clearly evident that Irma and Maria were still living on the island in a very significant way. Can you talk about the psychological impact of those storms and what it means to still be living through the protracted recovery of events like that? Because I imagine that that was singular for many, many generations, a singular event.
As you're saying this, the hairs on my arms stand up because I was in public service at the time of Hurricane Irma and Maria. I was in the Puerto Rico Federal Affairs Administration, which is the Washington, D.C. office of the governor. And from, you know, one moment to the next, we went from, you know, being in office where we received the governor, you know, every few weeks or every couple months, take him up to Congress, you know, take him to federal agencies and kind of generally advocate for the agenda, to the only fully functioning entity in the entire government of Puerto Rico when the entire government and the society as a whole had lost electricity, lost clean water access, were plunged into darkness. Telecommunications were down across the island. Thousands of people were injured and, you know, eventually we found out, you know, died through the hurricane and its aftermath. And it was a devastating period. The period after that of the emergency response and then eventually the recovery was incredibly challenging because we faced a circumstance where we had a sitting United States president that didn't have to obtain electoral college votes in Puerto Rico. And he thought that, you know, we were just some kind of useless people that were a nuisance for him to deal with.
You blew a hole in the budget, I think was his line.
Yeah. And he projected a lot of his own characteristics onto people on the island in every kind of negative way that you can imagine. And it was really, really tough to be on the receiving end of that. Even though we were able to get Congress to approve of probably the largest post-disaster reconstruction package in history for any U.S. jurisdiction for the people of Puerto Rico, which is a credit to Congress, and it's a credit to bipartisanship in Congress, believe it or not. Unfortunately, the Trump administration, you know, basically kind of held on to that funding and, you know, limited its capacity to go out as much as possible. So they extended the recovery process. That vastly improved when President Biden came into office. He made a commitment to helping the money flow a lot more, and it has. But the reality is that the hurricanes didn't just hurt the island in the way that a storm hurts another state, it basically stripped off the facade of functionality for an infrastructure that has faced a systematic federal underinvestment for decades, right? Yeah. Because yeah. of the territorial inequality issue. So it just kind of stripped that facade off and it revealed something deeper that was there. The reason why the power in Puerto Rico wasn't able to be restored in some places in the island up to, you know, 8 to 10 months, which is just insane to think about yeah. as a lived experience. Is because our electric system basically had, you know, decades of underinvestment, decades of disrepair, and that's really directly related to the territorial situation. Right now, a lot of the federal disaster recovery funds have been put in place. A lot of repairs and improvements have been made, but there's still a huge pipeline of projects that are yet to be completed. In my estimate, it's probably going to take another 10, 12 years for a lot of that to be completed. And that's not unique to Puerto Rico. If you look at New Orleans and what they went through after Hurricane Katrina, a lot of those projects took, you know, anywhere from, you know, 8, 10, 12, 16 years to be fully developed. And New Orleans has never been exactly the same. And I think the same thing has happened in Puerto Rico. You know, we had a huge population drop as a result of Hurricanes Irma and Maria. And then that's kind of, you know, a permanent change there. What I see with hope is that employment has improved on the island. Our economic indicators have improved on the island. As horrible as the Fiscal Oversight Board's democratic deficit has been, we have increased fiscal transparency on the island. So we have a clear idea of where the money's being spent and on what and who's doing what. And that's a good thing coming out of PROMESA, because PROMESA wasn't all bad. 80% of our debt has been restructured. Now the question is, how can we make economic growth sustainable for the people of Puerto Rico and for our environment? And the answer is, you have to address the issue of territory status, and you will never be able to get full post-disaster recovery if you don't address the territory status, because you won't have the resources in Congress to fight for the implementation of the reconstruction in the best way. And also, you continue subjecting Puerto Rico to that territorial inequality, which leads to the underinvestment that allowed for Hurricane Maria and Irma to be so devastating to begin with.
Yeah. My friend, I would love to someday grab some deep fried plantains and a drink on the beach in Luquillo.
I love it. Yeah.
and I wish you the best of luck in this effort. And really what I wish for is that whatever the will of the Puerto Rican people is fully recognized and expressed down the road. Where can people get in touch with your organization if they're looking for support? And what types of support are you looking for from the general public?
Well, you know, I think the best place to go is to our website, which is pr51st.com. We're also now on Twitter, X, YouTube, Instagram, LinkedIn. And there we can provide information about kind of what's going on with Puerto Rico, what actions Congress is taking impacting the island. But there's also amazing resources that, you know, activists and supporters and allies can take to contact their member of Congress, send them letters and emails to address this issue. You can, you know, also join part of our grassroots network with the Puerto Rico Statehood Action Network. So there's all kinds of opportunities for people to get involved and sign up on our emails, receive our information, and basically help to realize that the American public, Congress is holding colonial territories on our behalf. So until the American public tells Congress, hey, that's not cool, stop doing this, Congress is going to continue doing it. So all of us, every single listener, every single person in your audience, every American has a stake in this, because this is being done on our behalf. So if we stand up, Congress is going to listen. The people of Puerto Rico are leading the effort because, you know, we're obviously the frontline impact of everything that's happening. But it's on all of us as a society to say, we don't want America to have colonies. Stop the colony and let Puerto Rico decide.
Well said. George, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it. And it's great to meet you. And I hope we can follow up on this
Definitely. When
you've made more progress. So if something has come up and you feel like there's new information to share, I know that our audience will be eager to hear it. And thank you again for taking the time.
Awesome. Thank you.